Section 8 of The Diary of a Provincial Lady by E. M. Delafield. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. May 28th. Mademoiselle returns and is greeted with enthusiasm, to my great relief. Robin and Vicky perhaps less like Jamaica children than I had feared. She has on new black and white check skirt, white blouse with frills, black kid gloves, embroidered in white on the backs, and black straw hat, almost entirely covered in purple violets, and informs me that the whole outfit was made by herself at a total cost of £1, 9 shillings and 4 halfpenny. The French undoubtedly thrifty and gifted in using a needle, but cannot altogether stifle conviction that a shade less economy might have produced better results. She presents me in the kindest way with a present in the shape of 2 blue glass flower vases of spiral construction and adorned with gilt knobs at many unexpected points. Vicky receives a large artificial silk red rose, which she fortunately appears to admire, and Robin a small affair in wire that is intended, says Mademoiselle, to extract the stones out of cherries. Memo. Interesting to ascertain number of these ingenious contrivances sold in a year. Am privately rather overcome by Mademoiselle's generosity, and wish that we could reach the level of the French in what they themselves describe as petit soin. Place the glass vases in conspicuous position on dining-room mantelpiece, and am fortunately just in time to stem comment which I see rising to Robert's lips when he sits down to midday meal and perceives them. After lunch, Robin is motored back to school by his father, and I examine Vicky's summer wardrobe with Mademoiselle, and find that she has outgrown everything she has in the world. May 30th. Arrival of time and tide. Find that I have been awarded half of second prize for charming little effort that, in my opinion, deserves better. Robert's attempt receives an honourable mention. Recognise pseudonym of first prize winner as being that adopted by Mary Kelway. Should like to think that generous satisfaction envelops me at dear friend's success, but am not sure. This week's competition announces itself as a triolet, literary form that I cannot endure and rules of which I am totally unable to master. Receive telephone invitation to lunch with the Frobishers on Sunday. I accept, less because I want to see them, than because a change from domestic roast beef and gooseberry tart always pleasant. Moreover, absence makes work lighter for the servants. Memo. Candid and intelligent self-examination as to motive, etc., often leads to very distressing revelations. Constrained by conscience and recollection of promise to Barbara to go and call on old Mrs. Blenkinsop, receive many kind inquiries in village as to my complete recovery from measles, but observe singular tendency on part of everybody else to treat this very serious affliction as a joke. Find old Mrs. B.'s cottage in unheard-of condition of hygienic ventilation, no doubt attributable to Cousin Maud. Windows all wide open, and casement curtains flapping in every direction. Very cold east wind more than noticeable. Mrs. B., surely fewer shawls than formerly, sitting quite close to open window, and not far from equally open door, seems to have turned curious shade of pale blue, and shows tendency to shiver. Room smells strongly of furniture polish and black lead. Fireplace, indeed, exhibits recent handsome application of the latter, and has evidently not held fire for days past. Old Mrs. B. more silent than of old, and makes no reference to silver linings and the like. Can spirit of optimism have been blown away by living in continual severe draught? Cousin Maud comes in almost immediately. Have met her once before, and say so, but she makes it clear that this encounter left no impression, and has entirely escaped her memory. Am convinced that Cousin Maud is one of those people who pride themselves on always speaking the truth. She is wearing brick-red sweater, feel sure she knitted it herself, tweed skirt, longer at the back than in front, and large row of pearl beads. Has very hearty and emphatic manner, and uses many slang expressions. I ask for news of Barbara, and Mrs. B., voice a mere bleat by comparison with Cousin Maud's, says that the dear child will be coming down once more before she sails, and that continued partings are the lot of the aged and to be expected. I begin to hope that she is approaching her old form, but all is stopped by Cousin Maud, who shouts out that we are not to talk rot, and it's a jolly good thing that Barbara has got off the hooks at last, poor old girl. We then talk about golf handicaps, Rodine, Cousin Maud's dear old school, and the baby Austin. More accurate statement would perhaps be that Cousin Maud talks and we listen. No sign of Life of Disraeli or any other literary activities, such as old Mrs. B. used to be surrounded by, and do not like to inquire what she now does with her time. Disquieting suspicion that this is probably settled for her without reference to her wishes. Take my leave, feeling depressed. Old Mrs. B. rolls her eyes at me as I say good-bye, and mutters something about not being here much longer. But this is drowned by hearty laughter from Cousin Maud, who declares that she is nothing but an old humbug, and will see us all out. Am escorted to the front gate by Cousin Maud, who tells me what a topping thing it is for old Mrs. B. to be taken out of herself a bit, and asks if it isn't good to be alive on a bracing day like this. She'd like to reply that it would be far better for some of us to be dead, in my opinion, but spirit for this repartee fails me, and I weakly reply that I know what she means. I go away before she has time to slap me on the back, which I feel certain will be the next thing. Had had in mind amiable scheme for writing to Barbara tonight, to tell her that old Mrs. B. is quite wonderful, and showing no signs of depression. But this cannot now be done, and after much thought do not write at all, but instead spend the evening trying to reconcile grave discrepancy between account-book, counterfoils of cheque-book, and rather unsympathetically worded communication from the bank. June 1st. Sunday lunch with the Frobishers, and four guests staying in the house with them, introduced as, apparently, Colonel and Mrs. Brightpie, which seems impossible, Sir William Reddy, or perhaps even Redé, and my sister Violet, latter quite astonishingly pretty, and wearing admirable flowered tussore that I, as usual, mentally try upon myself, only to realise that it would undoubtedly suggest melancholy saying concerning mutton dressed as lamb. The Colonel sits next to me at lunch, and we talk about fishing, which I have never attempted, and look upon as cruelty to animals, but this, with undoubted hypocrisy and moral cowardice, I conceal. Robert has my sister Violet, and I hear him at intervals telling her about the pigs, which seems odd, but she looks pleased, so perhaps is interested. Conversation suddenly becomes general, as topic of present-day dentistry is introduced by Lady F. We all, except Robert, who eats bread, have much to say. Memo. Remember to direct conversation into similar channel when customary periodical deathly silence descends upon guests at my own table. Weather is wet and cold, and had confidently hoped to escape tour of the garden, but this is not to be, and directly lunch is over we rush out into the damp. Boughs drip onto our heads, and water squelches beneath our feet, but rhododendrons and lupins undoubtedly very magnificent, and references to Ruth Draper not more numerous than usual. I find myself walking with Mrs. Brightpie, who evidently knows all that can be known about a garden. Fortunately, she is prepared to originate all the comments herself, and I need only say, "Yes, isn't that an attractive variety?" and so on. She inquires once if I have ever succeeded in making the dear blue Grandiflora magnificens superbiensis, or something like that, feel really happy and at home in this climate, to which I am able to reply with absolute truth by a simple negative, at which I fancy she looks rather relieved. Is her own life perhaps one long struggle to acclimatise the GMS? And what would she have replied if I said that, in my garden, the dear thing grew like a weed? Memo. Must beware of growing tendency to indulge in similar idle speculations, which lead nowhere, and probably often give me the appearance of being absent-minded in the society of my fellow creatures. After prolonged inspection, we retrace steps, and this time find myself with Sir William R. and Lady F. talking about grass. Realise with horror that we are now making our way towards the stables. Nothing whatever to be done about it, except keep as far away from the horses as possible, and refrain from any comment whatever, in hopes of concealing that I know nothing about horses except that they frighten me. Robert, I notice, looks sorry for me, and places himself between me and terrifying-looking animal that glares out at me from loosebox and curls up its lip. Feel grateful to him, and eventually leave stables with shattered nerves and soaking wet shoes. Exchange customary graceful farewells with host and hostess, saying how much I have enjoyed coming. Query here suggests itself, as often before. Is it utterly impossible to combine the amenities of civilization with even the minimum of honesty required to satisfy the voice of conscience? Answer still in abeyance at present. Robert goes to evening service, and I play Halma with Vicky. She says that she wants to go to school, and produces string of excellent reasons why she should do so. I say that I will think it over, but am aware, by previous experience, that Vicky has almost miraculous aptitude for getting her own way, and will probably succeed in this instance as in others. Rather depressing Sunday supper, cold beef, baked potatoes, salad, and depleted cold tart, after which I write to Rose, the cleaners, the Army and Navy stores, and the County Secretary of the Women's Institute, and Robert goes to sleep over the Sunday pictorial. June 3rd. Astounding and enchanting change in the weather, which becomes warm. I carry chair, writing materials, rug and cushion into the garden, but am called in to have a look at the pantry sink, please, as it seems to have blocked itself up. Attempted return to garden frustrated by arrival of note from the village concerning garden fete arrangements, which requires immediate answer, necessity for speaking to the butcher on the telephone, and sudden realisation that laundry list hasn't yet been made out, and the van will be here at 11. When it does come, I have to speak about the tablecloths, which leads, do not know how, to long conversation about the Derby, the van speaking highly of an outsider, Trues, while I uphold the chances of Silver Flare, mainly because I like the name. Shortly after this, Mrs. S. arrives from the village to collect jumble for garden fete, which takes time. After lunch, sky clouds over, and Mademoiselle and Vicky kindly help me to carry chair, writing materials, rug and cushion into the house again. Robert receives letter by second post announcing death of his godfather, aged 97, and decides to go to the funeral on 5th of June. Memo. Curious but authenticated fact that a funeral is the only gathering to which the majority of men ever go willingly. Should like to think out why this should be so, but must instead unearth top hat and other accoutrements of woe, and try if open air will remove smell of naphthalene. June 7th. Receive letter. Why, in heaven's name, not telegram? From Robert, to announce that Godfather has left him £500. This strikes me as so utterly incredible and magnificent that I shed tears of pure relief and satisfaction. Mademoiselle comes in the midst of them, and on receiving explanation kisses me on both cheeks and exclaims, Ah, je m'en doutais. Voilà bien ce bon Saint-Antoine. Can only draw conclusion that she has, most touchingly, been petitioning heaven on our behalf, and very nearly weep again at the thought. Spend joyful evening making out lists of bills to be paid, jewellery to be redeemed, friends to be benefited, and purchases to be made out of legacy, and am only slightly disconcerted on finding that net total of lists, when added together, comes to exactly £1,320. June 9th. Return yesterday of Robert, and have every reason to believe that, though neither talkative nor exuberant, he fully appreciates newly achieved stability of financial position. He warmly concurs in my suggestion that great-aunt's diamond ring should be retrieved from Plymouth pawnbrokers in time to figure at our next excitement, which is the garden fete, and I accordingly hasten to Plymouth by nearest available bus. Not only do I return with ring. Pawnbroker, after a glance at the calendar, congratulates me on being just in time, but have also purchased new hat for myself, many yards of material for Vicky's frocks, a Hornby train for Robin, several gramophone records, and a small mauve bag for Mademoiselle. All give the utmost satisfaction, and I furthermore arrange to have hot lobster and fruit salad for dinner. These, however, not a great success with Robert, unfortunately, and he suggests, though kindly, that I was perhaps thinking more of my own tastes than of his when devising this form of celebration. Must regretfully acknowledge truth in this. Discussion of Godfather's legacy fills the evening happily, and I say that we ought to give a party, and suggest combining it with garden fete. Robert replies, however, and on further reflection find that I agree with him, that this would not conduce to the success of either entertainment, and scheme is abandoned. He also begs me to get garden fete over before I begin to think of anything else, and I agree to do so. June 12th. Nothing is spoken of but weather, at the moment propitious, but who can say whether similar conditions will prevail on 17th? Relative merits of having the tea laid under the oak trees or near the tennis court, outside price that can be reasonably asked for articles on jumble stall, desirability of having ice cream combined with lemonade stall, and the like. Date fortunately coincides with Robin's half-term, and I feel that he must and shall come home for the occasion. Expense, as I point out to Robert, now nothing to us. He yields. I become reckless, have thoughts of a house-party, and invite Rose to come down from London. She accepts. Dear old school friend Sissy Crabb, by strange coincidence, writes that she will be on her way to Land's End on 16th June. May she stay for 2 nights? Yes, she may. Robert does not seem pleased when I explain that he will have to vacate his dressing room for Sissy Crabb, as Rose will be occupying spare bedroom and Robin at home. This will complete house party. June 17th. Entire household rises practically at dawn in order to take part in active preparations for garden fete. Mademoiselle reported to have refused breakfast in order to put final stitches in embroidered pink satin boot bag for fancy stall, which she has, to my certain knowledge, been working at for the past 6 weeks. At 10 o'clock our vicar's wife dashes in to ask what I think of the weather, and to say that she cannot stop a moment. At 11 she is still here, and has been joined by several stallholders, and tiresome local couple called White, who want to know if there will be a tennis tournament, and if not, is there not still time to organise one? I reply curtly in the negative to both suggestions, and they depart, looking huffed. Our vicar's wife says that this may have lost us their patronage at the fete altogether, and that Mrs. White's mother, who is staying with them, is said to be rich, and might easily have been worth a couple of pounds to us. Diversion fortunately occasioned by unexpected arrival of solid and respectable-looking claret-coloured motor-car, from which Barbara and Crosby Carruthers emerge. Barbara is excited. Cece remains calm but looks benevolent. Our vicar's wife screams and throws a pair of scissors wildly into the air. They are eventually found in bran tub containing twopenny dips, and are the cause of much trouble, as small child who fishes them out maintains them to be bona fide dip, and refuses to give them up. Barbara looks blooming, and says how wonderful it is to see the dear old place quite unchanged. K cannot wholeheartedly agree with this, as it is not 3 months since she was here last. But fortunately she requires no answer, and says that she and C.C. are looking up old friends, and will return for the opening of the fete this afternoon. Robert goes to meet old school friend Sissy Crabb at station, and Rose and I to help price garments at Jumble Stall. Find that my views are not always similar to those of other members of committee. Why, for instance, only 3 and 6 pence, for grey georgette, only sacrificed reluctantly at 11th hour from my wardrobe. Arrival of Sissy Crabb, wearing curious wool hat which I at once feel would look better on Jumble Stall, is followed by cold lunch. Have made special point of remembering nuts and banana sandwiches for Sissy, but have difficulty in preventing Robin and Vicky, to whom I have omitted to give explanation, making it obvious that they would prefer this diet to cold lamb and salad. Just as tinned pineapple and junket stages passed, Robin informs me that there are people beginning to arrive, and we all disperse in desperate haste and excitement to reappear in best clothes. I wear red foulard and new red hat, but find, as usual, that every petticoat I have in the world is either rather too long or much too short. Mademoiselle comes to the rescue and puts safety pins in shoulder straps, one of which becomes unfastened later and causes me great suffering. Rose, also as usual, looks nicer than anybody else in delightful green delaine. Sissy Crabb also has reasonably attractive dress, but detracts from effect with numerous scarab rings, cameo brooches, tulle scarves, enamel buckles, and barbaric necklaces. Moreover, she clings, I think mistakenly, to little wool hat, which looks odd. Robin and Vicky both present enchanting appearance, although Mary's 3 little Kelways, all alike in pale rose tussore, undeniably decorative. Natural wave in hair of all three, which seems to me unjust, but nothing can be done until Vicky reaches age suitable for permanent waving. Lady Frobisher arrives, 10 minutes too early, to open fete, and is walked about by Robert until our vicar says, "Well, he thinks perhaps that we are now all gathered together." Have profane impulse to add, "in the sight of God," but naturally stifle it. Lady F. is poised gracefully on little bank under the chestnut tree, our vicar beside her, Robert and myself modestly retiring a few paces behind, our vicar's wife kindly, but mistakenly, trying to induce various unsuitable people to mount bank, which she humorously refers to as the platform, when all is thrown into confusion by sensational arrival of colossal Bentley, containing Lady B., in sapphire blue and pearls, with escort of fashionable creatures, male and female, apparently dressed for Ascot. "Go on, go on," says Lady B., waving hand in white kid glove, and dropping small jewelled bag, lace parasol, and embroidered handkerchief as she does so. Great confusion while these articles are picked up and restored, but at last we do go on, and Lady F. says what a pleasure it is to her to be here today, what a desirable asset a village hall is, and much else to the same effect. Our vicar thanks her for coming here today, so many claims upon her time. Robert seconds him with almost incredible brevity. Someone else thanks Robert and myself for throwing open these magnificent grounds. Tennis court, 3 flower borders, and microscopic shrubbery. I look at Robert, who shakes his head, thus obliging me to make necessary reply myself, and our vicar's wife, with undeniable presence of mind, darts forward and reminds Lady F. that she has forgotten to declare the fete open. This is at once done, and we disperse to stalls and sideshows. Am stopped by Lady B., who asks reproachfully, "Didn't I know that she would have been perfectly ready to open the fete herself, if I had asked her? Another time," she says, "I am not to hesitate for a moment." She then spends 9 pence on a lavender bag, and drives off again with expensive-looking friends. This behaviour provides topic of excited conversation for us all throughout the whole of the afternoon. Everyone else buys nobly. Unsuitable articles are raffled. Raffling illegal. Winner to pay sixpence. Guesses are made as to contents of sealed boxes, number of currants in large cake, weight of bilious-looking ham, and so on. Band arrives, is established on lawn, and plays selections from the geisha. Mademoiselle's boot bag, bought by elegant purchaser in grey flannels, who turns out, on closer inspection, to be Howard Fitzsimmons. Just as I recover from this, Robin, in wild excitement, informs me that he has won a goat in a raffle. Goat has fearful local reputation, and is of immense age and savageness. Have no time to do more than say how nice this is, and he had better run and tell Daddy, before old Mrs. B, Barbara, C.C., and Cousin Maud all turn up together. Can baby Austin possibly have accommodated them all? Old Mrs. B, rather less subdued than at our last meeting, and goes so far as to say that she has very little money to spend, but that she always thinks a smile and a kind word are better than gold, with which I inwardly disagree. Am definitely glad to perceive that C.C. has taken up cast-iron attitude of unfriendliness towards Cousin Maud, and contradicts her whenever she speaks. Sports, tea, and dancing on the tennis lawn all successful, except possibly from point of view of future tennis parties, and even Robin and Vicky do not dream of eating final ice cream cornets and retiring to bed until 10 o'clock. Robert, Rose, Sissy Crabb, Helen Wills, and myself all sit in the drawing-room in pleasant state of exhaustion, and congratulate ourselves and one another. Robert has information, no doubt reliable, but source remains mysterious, to the effect that we have cleared 3 figures. All, for the moment, is couleur de rose. End of section 8.